RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for another health hacks this Monday morning here at RCR, and Dr. Glenn Davies, Reversal NZ, is back with us. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. No winter illnesses as of yet, and that's what we're here to talk about this morning. But I'm wondering, how do I know it's just one of those kind of winter illnesses or something worse, you know?
Yeah. So, fantastic question, and that's what we'll spend the majority of our time discussing this morning, Paul. It's how do you distinguish between an uncomplicated viral cold or a flu, and how do you distinguish that from potentially a more complicated problem like sinusitis or pneumonia, and how do we determine whether you need antibiotics or whether you don't?
Okay. First up, why are there more illnesses in winter? It's got to be something to do with the temperature, I'd take it.
That alone is a fantastic question, Paul, and it's been discussed a bit, but I'm not sure, even though that's such a simple question, I'm not sure we really know. One of the best explanations I had is that in the winter, more of us are inside in poorly ventilated environments, so you're more likely to contract a virus, say, whereas in the summer, the windows are open, we're more likely to be outside, we're not crammed into small spaces. I don't know if I completely buy it as an explanation, and I'm wondering if that vitamin D topic that we've discussed before might be behind it. Do our vitamin D levels drop during the winter? We've talked about this before. Sunlight allows the body to produce vitamin D, and vitamin D seems to be very important in preventing these winter illnesses. So is it that our vitamin D levels drop in times of less sunlight? And is that a better explanation for why we get these winter illnesses?
Yeah, I think if you're talking vitamin D, if people spend longer indoors and don't get out and go for a walk or have some exposure, because even in the winter, we still have ultraviolet light, don't we? I mean, it's still there.
Yeah, we do. The problem is that when we do go outside, we're pretty much covered up, aren't we? You know, our faces and our hands are probably exposed when we go for our walk. Interestingly, I was doing a little work in our paddock in the weekend, and it was warm. I took my shirt off trying to maximize my vitamin D exposure on a for an hour in the middle of the afternoon.
Oh, good on you. Okay, so what do we normally see around this time of the year? Just what, your flus, your colds,
flus and colds. And there's a 40% increase in antibiotic prescription during the winter. But, you know, fundamental point, antibiotics do not treat viral infections, so the common cold and influenza, but antibiotics potentially treat bacterial infections. The difficulty is telling them apart. So let's have a go at that. But the problem here is that the symptoms and the signs cross over. But let's do our best to identify what a viral cold or flu looks like. So it's more likely to start with sneezing and more likely to begin with a clear, runny nose and a mild sore throat. They're the, you know, main characteristics of a viral cold. Interesting discussion about snot. So this blew me away, but I think it's a true statistic. Normally, so like just normally when we're well, we produce 1 to 2 liters of mucus from our nose and from our lungs that we swallow. So 1 to 2 liters per day at normal times. It seems excessive, doesn't it? You know, like, but that's what the article I was reading said. And we have these goblet cells within our nose which produce the mucus. And then we have these ciliated cells. They have tiny little hairs on them. They create this escalator which moves the snot backwards into the nasopharynx, and then we swallow it. So it's an amazing method of, if we do inhale a virus or a bacteria, it gets moved along this escalator and it goes down into our stomach and the stomach acid destroys it. So
wow.
1 to 2 liters, when we get a cold or a flu, that doubles. You know, I'm not sure if I completely believe it, but that's talking about 4 liters of snot.
I'm visualizing that in, you know, in bottles or something. That's a lot.
Yeah, it seems a lot. Maybe the 1 liter is a bit more realistic. But what happens when we get a virus, those cilia get sort of paralyzed, and that's why the snot comes out the front of the nose. Or if we're talking about the lungs, we cough it up. You know, I'm actually, now I'm thinking of that statistic, I wonder if it includes the mucus that's produced inside the gut as well, because, you know, 2 liters, that sounds excessive. We'd just about drown, wouldn't we? But
yeah, anyway, where does the body make that from? Do you have to be well hydrated to be expressing?
I would expect so. And one of the key points with, you know, managing viral illnesses is that you do have to be well hydrated. I guess if you've doubled the amount of mucus you're producing, then yes, you would have to be well hydrated.
So there's a whole sort of protection, layered protection system for, you know, trying to divert pathogens or viruses or bacteria, whatever, into the gut, because that dissolves away in the stomach acid, I would imagine.
And that's a really key point, Paul. It's like every time we get exposed to a virus, we don't get sick. Now, like we must be exposed to viruses, I guess, all the time. But this defense system of mucus production and then this escalator that moves it back and then we swallow it and the stomach acid destroys it, that must be happening all the time. It's if there's a breakdown in that system that the virus or the bacteria can actually penetrate and make us unwell.
And that's how we get unwell. Okay.
Yeah,
sadly. It's not quite 100% yet, but maybe give it another 100,000 years, who knows? Okay, So is there anything in the onset of symptoms that can give you a clue as to whether it's viral or bacterial? Because you mentioned at the start, what was the old way of dealing with this? I remember as a kid being sick, Dr. Patterson would come around, and after a phone call, I don't think that happens so much anymore, and have a quick check with his bag there, and then basically you're in bed until you feel better. That was what I remember as a kid anyway.
Yeah, and it hasn't changed very much, apart from you'd probably have a phone triage rather than a house call. But if you are pretty confident that it's just a viral cold or a flu, you would rest. And the logic of resting, I assume, is that the immune system requires a lot of energy to mount an immune response. I recall reading at one stage that people have glandular fever, which is a viral illness. 90% of the daily energy production is used to mount that viral. That immune response.
So 90.
Your immune system requires a lot of energy, and that's the logic of going to bed and resting. So you're not spending all that energy, I guess, working. You're allowing the immune system to do its job. I guess if you have the body's having to divide its energy between feeding out the cows and mounting an immune response, potentially the immune response could be compromised. So I think that's the logic of resting. As you mentioned earlier, Paul, hydration, and if we are producing sort of 2 liters of mucus, we want to be well hydrated to do that. And then some simple things. Paracetamol. Now, there's quite a lot of debate about using paracetamol because I think the fever is part of the immune response. So if you dampen down the fever by taking paracetamol, are you effectively interfering with the body's own defense mechanism? So, you know, my thought with paracetamol is if you're really miserable, or if your temperature is particularly high, or your child has a particularly high temperature, yes, absolutely. But if it's just a mild fever, I wouldn't be routinely taking paracetamol because I think that the fever is part of the body's response. So you've got your rest, your hydration, paracetamol if you need it, and then you've got some symptomatic, like treatments, and that might be something like an Otrivin decongestant nose spray. And you feel really miserable when your nose is all clogged and you can't breathe properly. And those nasal decongestants seem to work pretty well. That's over the counter. So it's a pretty simple recipe for managing it. There's another couple of things. Honey seems to have, taken orally, potentially has some impact. And then zinc, there's not a lot of research, but three clinical trials which have shown a benefit from taking zinc. And zinc is one of the main things that the immune system needs to do its job. It's something around a standard zinc tablet that you get on prescription is 50 milligrams, so something like 50 milligrams of zinc. And then vitamin C, I think the clinical trials on vitamin C are weak, but I'm sure it can do no harm, and I would be throwing in some vitamin C with the zinc. So the recipe for a viral cold or flu is rest, hydration, some paracetamol or nasal decongestant if you need symptomatic relief, and then some vitamin C and some zinc, and that's basically your recipe.
The thing about fever and the temperature of a fever, that interests me when you mention that. So the body temperature goes up, right, in a fever. Is that kind of to sweat out or fry out or destroy beyond their temperature range, let's say, whatever is the immune system's responding to? Is that what's going on there?
I think it is. Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. It's part of the body's effort to destroy the virus or bacteria.
Okay. Now, bacterial infections.
Yeah, so bacterial infections, different from a virus. Viruses, antibiotics will do zero, absolutely nothing for a virus. So there's no point taking an antibiotic if you've just got a cold. However, antibiotics can be life-saving if you have a severe bacterial infection. You know, antibiotics have been around since around the Second World War, and they must have made this massive, massive difference to death rates, having the ability to treat infections. The thing is, we have to be respectful of their use, because if you use antibiotics inappropriately, you can create antibiotic resistance. And then when you do need that antibiotic for a serious infection, it may not work. You know, so that's this whole idea of judicious and appropriate uses of antibiotics, not using them for a virus, but using them appropriately when they're needed. So how might you know if they're needed? So a viral infection, usually you would expect the symptoms to resolve by about 7 to 10 days, apart from the cough. The cough can go on for about 4 weeks. You know, so it still could be a post-viral cough at 4 weeks. But signs of a significant bacterial infection are if you have sinus pain, so pain over the cheeks and behind the eyes. And if that has persisted past the 10 days, you may have a sinus infection and may require an antibiotic. So that's one.
Right.
Then this whole issue of strep throat. So the concern with strep throat or, like tonsillitis is that it can lead to the severe consequence, which is called rheumatic fever. It's in an autoimmune response to the streptococcus, and it can lead to heart damage. How do you know if you're at risk of your throat infection becoming rheumatic fever? So again, no absolute rules here, but it's more likely to occur if people are living in overcrowded or poor housing environments. More likely to occur between the ages of 3 and 35, and more likely to occur if people are Maori or Pacific Islander. And a combination of those factors would make it more likely, will make you more at risk of rheumatic fever. So a throat swab, if the throat infection is severe and you are in those categories, is probably a good idea. And the antibiotics don't have to be started straight away. You can wait for the throat swab to come back, and that may be an indication for treating a pussy throat or a severely sore throat with antibiotics. So that's the rheumatic fever issue. And then pneumonia. So generally with pneumonia, you can hear it with a stethoscope, but it would require a consultation with the doctor to listen. So that's probably the third main indication for an antibiotic. And then the other one, the fourth one, is ear infections. So if the ear pain lasts for more than 48 hours, if it's bilateral or if the child is very young or very sick, again, they may be indications for an antibiotic. So you can see how it gets a little bit tricky, because all these symptoms are overlapping. And that's where the consultation and the clinical skill of the doctor comes into play, is trying to decide when the antibiotic is needed and when it's not. And often the doctor's not exactly sure because of this crossover, and they might do a thing called a back pocket prescription, which is you get the antibiotic prescription, but you're told not to take it unless the symptoms get worse or right. they don't resolve. You know, so can see how it's a little bit of a tricky topic, but I think where this really leads to is, I think some people have lost their confidence with distinguishing when somebody is mildly unwell and likely to have a cold, and severely unwell and needing that doctor's consultation. I think probably in our parents' generation, that skill or confidence in making that decision for yourself or for our children was there in the community, but it seems to have been lost. And what I'd love to see come back is that confidence in making that decision. And that's where you might talk to your auntie, you might talk to your mum, you might get a little bit of a group think on how unwell is my child. You know, and I think when we had a village, I think that shared knowledge, particularly in the elders, was there. I think now we're living in these nuclear families, we're separated. I think we've lost that confidence to some extent.
Yeah, good point. I'm just trying to think what we did with our kids. I don't think we jumped too soon, is my memory, and that's going back 30 years now. Again, I'm putting myself in the parent's role. You got a kid who's sick, and you're trying to sort of work out whether, you know, we race off to the doctor or just keep it at home, and all those overlapping things. Are there any thresholds or, you know, signs that can be used to kind of navigate that, to measure that? You want to talk to friends too, wouldn't you? And say, hey, have your kids had anything? Are they okay? Do they come through? And kind of get that information too, I would have thought.
Yeah, it's much easier for adults. For particularly very young children, the signs are like a very fast or increased respiratory rate, increased pulse rate, or a very high temperature, like above 39 degrees Celsius. But the main sign that I look for is the child lethargic and disinterested? You know, is this a baby with a fever that's still feeding and still interactive and still involved, or is this child gone lethargic and floppy and disinterested? That's my one clinical sign. If a parent tells me that on the phone, I'm saying you come straight in. You know, this is not normal for a child to do that. So right. that's my one sign. For adults, we used to use that sign, what color is your sputum or your snot? But okay. In fact, it's a very unreliable sign. In fact, it's of no use, because it's actually the neutrophils, the white blood cells, getting attracted there that creates the colour of the snot. They actually have got a, some of the neutrophils have got a greenish tinge to them. So that sign, is your snot dark green or yellow, completely unreliable. What might you do if you're an adult? So we talked about the tender sinuses, the duration of the symptoms, you know, they've lasted a lot longer. Another really interesting sign is you're starting to get better. So your viral infection is resolving in that sort of 7 to 10 days, and then you get sick again. That's probably an indication of a secondary bacterial infection. So that's quite a good sign. But interestingly, not all bacterial infections or secondary bacterial infections require an antibiotic, because obviously, back to talking about your grandfather, we're able to clear bacterial infections ourselves. Our immune system can still do that, you know, so we don't always have to have an antibiotic, you know. So it's not an easy topic. It's I don't ever want to be emphatic, because if I'm emphatic about saying you don't need an antibiotic, then potentially people could get very, very sick and present late. Equally, I don't want to create a definite rule. If your symptoms have lasted more than 7 days, you must go and see a doctor, because, you know, clearly viral infections can last longer. So it's that confidence in being able to judge if your child is unwell or if your parent is unwell, you know, that's the confidence that we used to have in society that I think we've lost.
The numbers, have they stayed about the same, you know, for people and their ailments and what they get in winter, or has there been an uptick, or does it sort of vary? I'm just curious.
I think it varies from year to year, because sometimes the influenza is more severe than at other times. So, yeah, it definitely varies from year to year. I guess the sunlight levels probably affect that.
Yeah.
The temperature does, yeah. So it varies, yep.
Okay, and if you max out on antibiotics, that's not good for your immune system in the end, I would imagine. Does it detrain? Can it detrain your system? I guess I'm trying to think.
So there's two parts to your question. One is you as an individual. One of my biggest concerns about taking an unnecessary antibiotic is the impact it has on the microbiome, bacteria in your gut. You know, potentially you can kill off the good bacteria, the protective bacteria, and that has potentially really negative impacts on your global health, including your immunity. So that's a concern as an individual. But at a more population level, this idea of antibiotic resistance, and a really good example is when penicillin was the only antibiotic, all the bacteria, I hope I'm not exaggerating, but say virtually all the antibiotic, all the bacteria were treated by penicillin. But over time, as we've used it, some of those bacteria are now resistant, and Staphylococcus aureus, which is the one that causes skin infections, is almost universally resistant to penicillin, and you need to use flucloxacillin. The idea of creating these superbugs, which are resistant to multiple antibiotics, and I guess eventually getting to the point where no antibiotics work for them, that creates a major, major problem, particularly with some of these already highly resistant bacteria that we see in hospital. So you would have heard the talk about the hospital bugs that are multi-drug resistant. You know, that's the concern if we're not judicious with our antibiotic use. And the other point is we don't point the finger just at doctors, because there is a lot of antibiotics that are used in bringing up animals, so the use of antibiotics in farmed animals, but the use of antibiotics in veterinary practice. So we require the same judicious use of antibiotics to be used by vets, but I think the biggest issue is the way that we're farming, and we're using antibiotics in farmed animals which I just don't think should happen at all. If we were farming with better farming practices, like we've seen with getting rid of the caged chickens, you know, if we're seeing that improved farming practice, we're not going to have to use the antibiotics in animals, which I think is one of the biggest issues with antibiotic resistance. So that improved farming practices is probably number one.
I got two more questions I want to ask. And folks, I know it's around breakfast time, so forgive me. Back to snot. Yeah. okay, so the colour is irrelevant, but what about the chunkiness of it?
Good question. Don't know. Okay. The stuff I was reading talked about volume and colour. Chunkiness, don't know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, runny versus chunky. That's what I was thinking. And a lot of people wonder about this. I do myself. And up to you how you want to answer it. But is it worth taking a flu vaccine to try and get ahead of flu? I haven't ever had a flu vaccine, and I've only ever had one bad, what I would call influenza, and that was years ago, and I was out for 3 weeks. But I got better, obviously. I'm just wondering if that's, you know, tools in the toolbox. Is that a good one?
Yeah, so influenza is a viral infection. People who are unwell, so let's say an older person who has chronic obstructive airways disease, they are far more likely to get a significant bacterial infection like a pneumonia if they got that initial influenza. So people who are at risk of bacterial complications, I think there is an argument for them having an influenza vaccine. Somebody who's 18-year-old and well, they're very unlikely to get pneumonia from getting influenza or a cold, so probably less argument for them having it. You know, and I think the free influenza vaccine is for people over the age of 65. You know, there's good logic in that. They're the people who are more likely to get a secondary bacterial infection than somebody who's 30. So that's, I guess, the nuance around your question.
There's quite a few nuances then that you've got to sort of balance off and think about before you, and this comes back to that having the confidence thing that you mentioned earlier, before you hit the red button, you know?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I'm disappointed about recently is that we've seen this creation of fear around viral illnesses that I don't think was there to the same degree in the past. You know, and I don't think we should ever be creating fear. I think we should be providing knowledge and empowerment and confidence balanced against how do I know when I actually really am sick and do need to see the doctor. That's why this is a difficult topic, and I think many doctors sort of shy away from discussing it in a public forum like we are today. The fear of someone saying, oh, but Dr. Davies said on that reality radio show, not that I don't need antibiotics, you know, and clearly I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
Equally, Dr. Davies said if my symptoms lasted for more than 7 days, I have to, you know, and general practices become overwhelmed with people turning up with mild viral infections. That's why this is a difficult topic and people shy away from it. I would like people to retain their confidence in their innate ability to make those decisions, not for them not to be based on fear, but for them to be based on education and bring in, like you mentioned, bring in other people into this conversation. Ask your wise auntie, your mum, what they think. You know, because that's what used to happen in the past when we lived in villages. You know, I'm sure there would have been a discussion before ringing the doctor. You know, so that's, I guess, what I'm hoping might come back into society.
Again, well said. Well, there goes another health axe. Thank you, Dr. Glenn Davies, reversalnz.co.nz. And if anyone has any questions or queries, feel free to send them in and we'll forward them off. And I think you're taking a break next week, Glenn, but you'll be back again after that. And then people will be starting to notice that the days are getting longer. and the lights around a bit more and not too far away from, you know, that dingy, dark, dingy period. And then we can all worry about what we get in summer, though I don't know what that is. Sunburn, probably, potentially.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. And I hope people have found that discussion useful and not just more confused than they were before.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.